guess before beginning, I'd like to thank my two collaborators. So pretty much everything I'm going to be talking about was either done by Paul Chesler before I started working on this, or after I joined up. And we've also been helped as well with some of the analytic calculations by Pyotr Sharapka, and both of them are postdocs in the high energy group at Harvard. Okay, so let me begin with kind of a simple recap. So a superfluid is a phase of matter in which a global U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken. And for a sort of high energy audience, the simplest example of this would be complex phi to the fourth theory with a Mexican hat potential. And in condensed matter physics, this U1 symmetry is usually particle conservation. And so a simple way to see this is just that, you know, if you have your creation and annihilation operators, your Hamiltonian will usually be invariant under these phase rotations. And this actually does show up in microscopic example. Well, it's also, you know, there are superfluids in liquid helium, but that's too experimental for me. So the most experimental thing I can handle is this integer filling 2D Bose-Hubbard model, where there's a superfluid phase when basically the on-site repulsion energy is small enough compared to the hopping energy. No, you need the integer filling.
So you're talking about relativistic superfluids?
For this particular model, yes. But for most of the talk, I won't be. For most of the talk, I won't be talking about relativistic.
You will not be talking about relativistic. Yeah.
No. Yeah. This is just a simple.
Oh, so this is a superfluid energy, not just it's the U over two integer filling.
Oh, okay. If it matches up with that L, an integer filling. Okay. Fair enough. Okay, and we'll be interested in superfluid turbulence. So what we'll be very interested in are topological defects called vortices. And essentially, if you have a vortex at the origin, you know, far from the vortex, the order parameter can be approximately constant. But its phase is undetermined, and this phase essentially can slowly vary as you move around the vortex, and it can wind around any integer W number of times. In particular, we'll be focusing for simplicity on the dynamics of either W equals plus 1 or W equals minus 1 vortices. These are stable excitations, although they're very highly gapped. If you have sort of higher winding number of vortices, these will typically break up if you kick them a little bit into smaller vortices, which are a collection of plus one or minus one vortices has much lower energy. And the superfluid velocity, V, is defined as the gradient of this phase, theta, divided by some mass scale in the problem M. And I have a little cartoon here of the red vortex with the blue lines denoting its velocity field.
Is it higher finite temperature?
Is what at finite
temperature?
We'll be doing both zero temperature and finite temperature. So at finite temperature, I'll always implicitly be assuming that the density of vortices is such that essentially the coherence length associated with finite T is very large compared to the intervortex spacing. And the dynamics of many vortices is chaotic, and this is what I'm going to call superfluid turbulence. Now, it's not at all a priori obvious that this should have anything to do with classical turbulence. Why is it chaotic? There are hundreds of coupled nonlinear differential equations. I don't have a formal proof for you, but
point particles, and you're saying vortices are special in the sense that extended objects for chaos.
I don't know exactly. I would say most mathematicians seem to think they're chaotic, so I would trust them. Certainly.
It's themselves. Just imagine in between particles how they move.
No, but this is out for point particles.
Dissipation.
Dissipation doesn't.
It's still chaotic with reasonable amounts of dissipation, as I'll show later.
Right. So that's one reason why it's going to be chaotic. You've got nothing to take the chaos out.
So do you mean like chaotic in the quantum system, like type, or I mean, when you're saying that you're...
I mean, for the most part, I'll be thinking about this as possible chaos in the sort of effective description of the superfluid order of parameters at various time. In particular, we're just going to be focusing on the vortices themselves, and so we get a set of classical ODEs that are chaotic. Okay, so I want to briefly go over the theory of classical turbulence, just to compare and contrast. So I have a cute picture I sort of shamelessly took off the web of a turbulent flow. This is probably some dye being injected in a three-dimensional flow. And these flows are essentially chaotic, and they're strongly nonlinear. And by that, I mean that the convective terms, like V dot del V, in the Navier-Stokes equations cannot be neglected. And these flows typically are characterized by structures on many different length and time scales, which makes them very hard to analyze analytically. One simple thing about them, though, which does seem to be very robust, is what's called the Kolmogorov five-thirds law. So let me sort of briefly explain where this comes from. So imagine that you take a three-dimensional fluid and you drive it with some force at a large length scale L. And this will inject energy into the system. And this energy essentially flows from mode to mode into the UV, where it gets dissipated at this length scale, which I'm calling C, which is related only to the viscosity and to the rate of energy injection by the driving force. This intermediate range is called the inertial range. And Kolmogorov in 1941 made the hypothesis that the physics in this range should approximately be scale invariant.
So this upper bound of the inertial range, one can just get by the dimensional analysis?
Yeah. It's basically the assumption that the only way energy can leave the inertial range is when a vortex gets very small so that it quickly dissipates and spreads out just by the viscous terms in the equations. So. And so if you have this assumption of scale invariance, epsilon and nu provide the only dimensional parameters in the problem. And you can show that the energy stored in the velocity fields at length scale 1 over k scales is epsilon to the 2/3 k to the minus 5/3. And this is just dimensional analysis, but this is my problem. It's in any dimension. There's a little trick here because I've integrated over all the angular directions in this energy. So if you imagine that you have the energy density in momentum space, I integrate over all angles at fixed, amplitude k, and that's what I'm calling E of k. So for that reason, it doesn't depend on the dimension.
You have this plus an R1, and then depending on the setup, you can see both cascades. The minus 5/3 and the R1 is minus 3.
Minus 3.
Okay, yeah, so the minus 3 is due to the structure.
Due to the UV structure. Okay. Now, as I hinted at, in three spatial dimensions or more, sort of heuristically, energy flows from the driving scale at large length scales to this UV dissipative scale, and this is called the direct cascade. In 1967, Krechnin pointed out, however, that in two spatial dimensions, there's a conservation law called entropy, which is basically the integral of the vorticity squared. And he argued that this had to imply that if you drive the system at length scale L, instead energy would flow all the way to the size of your box. And the reason for this is very simple. If you imagine that you have a vortex, and you tried to break this vortex into two smaller vortices, which then spread apart, the integral of omega squared would be larger after you broke those vortices apart than it was before. And so this process is essentially forbidden. And this essentially is what's behind this inverse cascade. And there's a picture here of turbulent flows in the atmosphere of Jupiter. This is the sort of big red spot, which, if I recall, is around the size of the Earth. But the main point I'm trying to make here is that this system is not necessarily being driven on scales this large. The flow sort of really does does transfer its energy to these very large scales, which we can observe.
Why did it take so long for people to discover this conservation law?
I think it was known for a while.
I don't think someone really noticed its applications for turbulence until 67, but I don't know why. I mean, I suspect kind of historically, most of the fluid community really focuses on three-dimensional flows, so maybe that's why. But I don't have a good answer. That's just a guess.
Which Reynolds number does the inertial range correspond to? Is that for intermediate?
Well, so the Reynolds number has to be very large for turbulence. And, well, the Reynolds number is roughly like 1 over the viscosity. So I guess you could.
Yeah. The Reynolds have to be very large for fully developed turbulence.
Right.
You could have partially developed turbulence or the onset of turbulence and still have a very low range. So where you're going to see a very, very messy vortex dynamics, then it does need a high Reynolds number. But you could have an intermediate state where turbulence kicks in and then gets out of it with a much lower value.
Sure.
Sorry, one question. As a consequence of this 2D, will the spots become bigger in Jupiter in the long run?
Unfortunately, I don't know the time scales for these flows, so it would take, I don't know. I don't have an answer, but that's very possible.
So the answer is other way.
Oh, I see. So it doesn't follow
that. That's the big one. Now, the big one is sufficiently big that I would worry about the scaleless or the subsimilar assumption.
Yeah, at some point, I mean, you lose energy either at very small scales due to viscosity or very large scales due to friction. So friction already takes energy of the system.
It's more complex than that.
Okay. All right, well, thanks. This inverse essay I would also like to point out has
sort of popped up recently because it occurs in conformal hydrodynamics, as was shown here, I guess, 2 years ago. And this is somewhat interesting because this conservation law, at least when you derive it in the easiest way, you assume incompressibility. So at least for conformal fluids, even when they're compressible, this is still a conserved quantity. And you can observe this inverse cascade in a holographic simulation as well. So first movie time. So is it going? OK, so this is a simulation from Paul's recent paper where they actually solved Einstein's equations in ADS4, asymptotically ADS4, and they were able to construct a turbulent black hole. But on the boundary, this is just describing a turbulent fluid. And the main point I want to make in this movie is just that you can see that the structures are getting larger as the system evolves. So to make that clear, if I...
What is it that we are seeing?
OK, so this is a plot of the vorticity. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yes. So this is the vorticity plotted as a function of x and y, your two coordinates, evolved in time.
Is this pure Einstein equations?
Yes, this is just Einstein equations. There's nothing else. No. This isn't a superfluid. This is a normal fluid, just a classical plasma in two spatial dimensions. So you take numerically, you can extract the stress tensor in the boundary theory by computing essentially the subleading correction to the metric, and from that, the time-like eigenvector is the velocity, and you can just take the curl of that epsilon mu nu rho d nu u rho. And that, u mu, and that gives you.
So if you compute some Biot scalar, it will also show this structure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, so you can also look at even metric structures, and you see the same sort of structure. But this, it's nicest to plot the vorticity just to silence any criticism that these are sort of coordinate dependent statements.
So I should think of this as like the magnitude of the curl of the velocity.
Omega is the vorticity, the strength of the vorticity, which is the curl of the velocity. So basically, the larger omega, the faster the fluid is spinning.
So all you take is Einstein's equation as a cosmological constant, and then how are you driving it?
So if I go back here, they basically started with a very unstable initial condition, of like velocity rolls like that, and then they just added a small perturbation to it.
So this is and, decay term. It's not driven.
This is not. Yes, thank you for pointing that. This is not driven. So the end state of this, because this is a viscous fluid, it will just relax to thermal equilibrium if you wait a long, long time. And yeah, so the main point I just want to note is you can see that, you know, there's many small structures here that evolve into much larger structures as time goes on.
So this is a turbulence in space-time. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
The gravitational field is called
the time room right now.
Okay, so this is the inverse cascade of classical fluids. And you could ask sort of to what extent is the picture for a superfluid similar? And this is actually very hard to do, especially at finite temperature, because we just don't have very good methods for numerical evaluation of the evolution of a finite temperature quantum system in real time. And that's really where holography has been quite helpful. Here we go. Okay, so this is a simulation from Paul's work with Hong Liu and Alan Adams last year. And I'll run this again. But I want to really point out that this is a very different looking simulation. Here, vortices are very well-defined objects. They look like they're point particles. And you can, in particular, see that large structures are not forming. Instead, what's happening is two vortices will come close to one another and annihilate. So this is a plot of basically the superfluid density. So red means it's sort of its vacuum expectation value. And blue is basically where the superfluid density vanishes. So this is near a vortex core. So if I run the simulation again, you can see that basically, so this is an alternating lattice of plus and minus vorticity. And you can see the large winding number of vortices immediately split into, I believe in this case, six winding number plus or minus one vortices. And then they collide together. And this is essentially very powerful evidence on its own for the direct cascade, even in two dimensions. And again, this is just because the dynamics is basically driven by these vortex annihilation events, which are pumping energy into the UV. And the reason you can get around entropy conservation is that when two vortices annihilate, the integral of omega squared will dramatically decrease. Okay, so essentially, vortex annihilation events, which are beyond the hydrodynamic regime, break your conservation law. Analogous to a classical fluid, you could imagine defining a power spectrum for the energy. This time, you want to put the superfluid density in as well so that it's finite at vortex cores. And rather remarkably, you can actually see Kolmogorov's five-thirds law in this data, despite the fact that this is not a classical fluid. It's not being driven. And this is this inertial range, if you want to call it that, persists for about a factor of 10 or so. I mean, this is the best that there is so far in the field. I agree. We're hoping to get it better in the next couple months.
Where was the turbulence there? I should look at the...
So the turbulence in this movie, I would basically just say that I'm defining superfluid turbulence to be the chaotic motion of these vortices. So unless you see some hidden integrability here, I would say that this is, for all intents and purposes in 2014, chaotic. And this is just what I'm calling superfluid turbulence. But it's not going to look like classical turbulence because you can't take a vortex and just smear it out because these vortices are really topological defects. So
where do the energy, where does it go?
So this is at finite temperature. Oh, thank you. This is a good point. So in this case, what happens, I'm not going to show these plots, but you can actually observe the energy holographically flowing into the normal fluid by observing at one of these annihilation events. Essentially, energy rushes through the horizon of a black hole, which is the sort of holographic way of saying that this is getting dumped into the sort of classical plasma background. So energy is dissipated into the normal fluid.
What happens if I show the curve of the velocity instead of like the amplitude of
the... ask Paul, but I assume it looked... Well, okay, actually, though, you know, the curl of the vorticity here, it would look like a bunch of delta functions. So, in fact, I'll basically show you plots which look like that in the second half of the talk. Okay, and just some more evidence that this is in fact a direct cascade. In this plot, you can see them essentially kick the system with a very long wavelength electric field, and you can see the energy essentially travel as a wave down this plot of E of K to shorter and shorter wavelengths. And this is the telltale sign of the direct cascade.
And this has not been seen before in simulation of Gross-Potecki equation, so.
No, not very well. The Gross-Potecki equation also differ as to whether the cascade is a direct cascade or an inverse cascade. I mean, the way they basically do finite temperature is they just add in a sort of an artificial damping term, but I would, at least to me, the holographic simulation, you sort of know you're doing finite temperature physics. I mean, whether or not you have to sort of take the pathology of the large N, you know, matrix theories, but you do know that you really are working at finite temperature.
Well, there's no heat, so. You're conserving energy at all times. There's no heat back, unlike some of the.
Yeah.
There's no explicit viscosity term in equations, also.
Yeah, well, they're hoping essentially
the damping term is playing a role similar to that.
But you're still conserving energy. Holographic, that's the advantage, I suppose.
Okay.
Sorry, as a related question. In the holographic description, does it mean that there are degrees of freedom that correspond to normal state? And
yes.
They are taking energy and.
Yes.
There are,
so there's in the holographic model they considered, there was sort of a. Like a giant, that you had a little superfluid on top of a giant sort of a giant stationary normal component. And so every vortex annihilation event just dumps a bit of energy into this normal fluid. You just have this damping term, but you don't explicitly have the normal fluid.
But in this calculation, the arc reaction, I would say, of the vortex annihilation is not accounted for.
The motion of the normal fluid is not accounted for in their simulations. But I will sort of provide some justifications for that later in the talk without holography. Okay. And finally, let me get to my experimental slide, which, as I mentioned, I'm very surprised that I'm doing this. But anyway, remarkably, there's actually been an experiment that has observed superfluid turbulence in a Bose-Einstein condensate of about a million sodium atoms. And so don't ask me for the sort of experimental details, because I don't know very much about this field. But essentially, what they do is they...
Which group is this?
It's, I think, Yong Il-shin in Korea. He's a former student, I believe, of Ketterly. Yeah. And so they basically cool down this Bose-Einstein condensate to very, very low temperatures. I believe they're at microkelvin or so temperatures. And then they take a laser beam and just shine it across. And that dumps energy into the superfluid and creates vortices. And then they just let the system evolve. And then they basically can do this experiment many times, and they take snapshots, you know, after a various number of seconds after the laser beam stops. And so you see essentially that the number of vortices in each snapshot is shrinking quite quickly, which you might think, oh, okay, this must mean there's a lot of vortex annihilation events. That's a little bit too fast, though, because unfortunately, their experimental apparatus sometimes just loses vortices. They, you know, leave the imaging region and you can't see them anymore. But they were able to remarkably actually observe some annihilation events in sort of real time, or at least stages of the annihilation events. I doubt these are not the same pair of vortices annihilating. But in any case, I just want to point out how similar it looks to the holographic calculation. So in particular, you see that, you know, these two vortices, as they approach, the sort of, you know, it starts to shear when they're within, you know, a core size or so of each other. Here you can see them really starting to merge and forming this crescent shape. And here you can see they've now merged. Essentially, atoms are filling in this gap, and this sort of crescent wave will propagate forward. There was also a paper earlier this week, which I don't understand very well, but they claim that they have an experimental method which could actually distinguish between plus or minus vortices. So here, basically, all they can do is keep track of the superfluid density. And so vortices are these black dots where there's not. Where the superfluid density shrinks to zero. But if you could observe plus or minus vortices, you could reconstruct the velocity spectrum because they're very simple for superfluids, or at least the rotational part of the spectrum is rather simple. And therefore, they could actually look at, say, the power spectrum in this experiment and check whether or not Kolmogorov scaling laws emerge in these experimental superfluids.
This, now presumably, this there is a finite, I mean, same number of vortices and antivortices. But in the famous rotating bucket experiment, you will produce vortices of the same type. What will happen to that? Will it become turbulent?
So I'll argue later. Well, I'll tell you now. Okay, so what we would argue would happen to that is basically you would create a bunch of plus sign vortices, and this hurricane would sort of slowly grow due to vortex drag. But you know, if you create it in our simulations, which admittedly were sort of very, you know, this is work in progress. But we do see if you do that fairly structures occur that look ordered. Let me put it that way. It looks almost like a vortex lattice arising. But don't quote me on that. I mean, this is preliminary.
Okay. So what are the goals
of this project? So the first thing we want to do is basically to systematically develop the effective field theory describing a turbulent superfluid at zero temperature. Now for this, we can actually take a microscopic action and literally compute the equations of motion, including their corrections due to the exchange of sound waves in the superfluid. And essentially then we want to argue that the inverse cascade is present at zero temperature, essentially because these corrections to the equations of motion, essentially because the leading order dynamics is not unstable. The correction will not sort of drive you away from the leading order dynamics. After that, we want to argue for the effects of the normal fluid on superfluid vortex dynamics at finite temperature. And in particular, what I hope to have convinced you of by the end of the talk is that vortex drag is a very reasonable physical mechanism that leads directly to the direct cascade. And finally, if time permits, I want to discuss some curious results we have that suggest that you can get very long-lived inverse cascades for small amounts of drag. And that's...
Sure, if you want to, yeah. Okay. We just mean that essentially it's only superfluid, and here there's, you know, something that you can dump energy into at a vortex core.
Okay, so we took the most popular theory of a non-relativistic superfluid, which is the Gross-Pitayevsky theory, which has this Lagrangian. Again, mu and lambda are both positive, so the vacuum of this theory has psi, has an expectation value for psi. And this equation admits stationary vortex solutions, which are essentially rotationally symmetric up to this overall phase factor, which is e to the plus or minus I theta. And that just denotes the winding number of the vortex, whether the vortex is clockwise or counterclockwise. In particular, these vortices have finite size. And you can show just by plugging this ansatz into that equation exactly what this length scale is. OK. Now, the next thing we do. So that was an exact solution to the equations of motion with one vortex. It's a stationary vortex, and that's not so exciting. Now we have n vortices. So our leading order guess is that you can just, you know, inspired by these simulations, you just put n vortices there. And you know, with the way I've written it, it's very easy to just add up all these chi's and thetas and get an ansatz. And you can show that to leading order, to order r star squared, in fact, where r star is the distance between two vortices, this is an exact solution to the equations of motion up to these c squared over r star squared suppressed corrections if these trajectories x dot, if these trajectories xn of t obey the equations of point vortex dynamics, which basically read that dxn dt is the superfluid velocity from every vortex except for vortex n passing through that core. So in particular, you know, if you just have a pair of vortices, right, each vortex has a purely rotational velocity field around it. That velocity field passes through the core of the other vortex, and that provides provides the velocity field Vn for that other kind. And analogous to a classical theory, or a quantum theory, if you like, although this procedure was sort of most explicitly done for a classical fluid last year, you can compute the fluctuation-corrected equations of motion arguably more efficiently by instead thinking about it analogous to quantum field theory. So in quantum field theory, we would, you know, you could imagine that you have some action where you know the exact solution, but now you turn on a very small perturbation, and your solution is no longer exact. But you could imagine saying, okay, if the correction to the to my original solution is very small, I can do a Taylor expansion of my action to second order and integrate out the fluctuating field. Okay? And this gives me the effective action for my theory. And so keep in mind that, you know, here our ansatz only depends on these xn of t's. So when we do this integral, we're left with a functional only of those xn of t's. Okay, so this is why I'm saying it's an effective action for those xn of t's. This is a formally equivalent procedure to just doing to just expanding out the equations of motion and doing linear response. But arguably, from this way, from this perspective, it's a little more it's a little easier, and we found it conceptually more helpful. The only thing I want to note about this procedure is that there are logarithmic divergences, but they have physical cutoffs in them. In particular, the UV cutoff is just the core size, and the size of your box, if you like, L, is the IR cutoff.
Sorry, but what are the coordinates of the vortices that you were mentioning before? What do they appear?
So in the original action, I literally take that ansatz, I just plug it into the Gross-Potayevsky action. Yeah. And that gives me my leading order action. And in fact, that gives you an action. You can explicitly do the integrals, carefully regularized, and you can show that the equations of motion for that action are precisely these equations.
Okay, but then
delta psi? So delta psi is, so, you know, if I write psi as this piece plus delta psi, there is always a delta psi for which this is an exact solution to the equations of motion. It's basically, it's going to be analogous to that, except here we're actually doing an integral over that. Right, we just expand out psi. We do linear response around that solution, and that's.
So the number of vertices is conserved.
Yes. Now, what could happen is that if this theory led to vortex annihilation, you could have a finite time blow up in your differential equations, where essentially two vortices meet at some finite time, and the equations would formally blow up. But physically, you could say, okay, I just have to delete these vortices from the system. But I'll argue that, in fact, for these models, the number of vortices is conserved.
So but delta psi probably takes care of long wavelength Goldstone-like modes, whereas vertices are different degrees of freedom. Is that correct?
So okay, so yeah, so the delta psi, you should think of it as essentially, you can do an analogous story with classical electromagnetism, right? So if you have an action for charged point particles plus gauge fields, you could formally, in the limit where those particles are moving slowly, you could integrate out the gauge fields, and you would find a Coulomb potential for those point charges. We're doing something exactly analogous here. And the delta psi's basically are virtual sound waves between two vortices. Yeah, but that's the analogy you should keep in mind. OK. Now, this is actually kind of an interesting thing to do, because there's a rather interesting historical controversy about what the answer should be. So probably in 1960 or so, the Hall, Venen, and Iordanski, I think maybe the first two wrote together and the third one independently, wrote down essentially what should the equation of motion look like. And they basically added a vortex mass at zero temperature. At finite temperature, there are new terms. But at zero temperature, the only extra term they added was a vortex mass. And although it's somewhat controversial what that vortex mass should, in fact, be, I would say maybe 80% of papers now, including the one from 2 years ago, would say that the mass of a vortex has this logarithmic divergence, in particular that its scaling is a log of L over C. So, you know, in this case, even if you had vortices that were very far apart, you know, if this log is really big, you might need to worry about it. When we do our path integral, though, we find something that looks very different. In particular, the two terms on the first line can be shown to cancel in the equations of motion. Each term individually cancels out. And the reason is as follows. Remember we were doing linear response. And so once we get to the equations of motion, we're allowed to assume that x dot n equals vn. And essentially, you can see that these guys both come in squared, but both of these things equal zero on point vortex dynamics. And so essentially, all of these log divergences cancel for the physical dynamics. So at least for vortices that only interact between each other and not with an external field, there is no logarithmic divergence either in the IR or in the UV in the equations of motion.
Similar questions arise about the mass of vortex. So there, the normal core plays some fundamental role.
Okay, I'm not really an expert. So
maybe Hall, Winnen, and Yudansky, they have in their physics some normal core in their mind.
Well, certainly can adopt their equations to be at finite temperature. Another thing you could do is you could imagine adding an external driving force, and that might restore some of these physical log divergences. I'm just going to say that for now, at the level of our computation, which is vortices that just interact with each other, these logs don't matter. It may be the case that if you add, a normal fluid as well, that these logs become physical again. But even that point aside, from the point of view of effective field theory, there's something very wrong with these HVI equations. In particular, this action only contains x dot n squared, but that's not the only term consistent with the symmetries of the problem at order. This is an order r star to the minus 2 term, convince yourself. But there's other terms that you could write down that consistent with those symmetries. In particular, you could take this guy, so this is the superfluid velocity through core n, and square it. We, in fact, do find when you do the path integral that this term is non-vanishing. And similarly, you can get a mass matrix connecting x dot n with x dot m for two different vortices. So the main point I want to make here, because as I said, this is work in progress, is that these HVI equations are incomplete. Okay? Not all terms that are consistent with symmetries have been included. And this really has to be done more systematically.
But Andy, you're not saying that your action is incompatible with the above one. Did they consider a driven system?
This Thompson et al. Paper, in particular, we are not in conflict with per se because they only had one vortex. Now, if you do this procedure for one vortex, you do, in fact, get this answer. But it doesn't actually matter, right? Because a single vortex is stationary. So x dot n is zero in the equations of motion. But I would argue that conceptually, it's very important to even if this mass formally shows up, we're showing that it doesn't really alter the dynamics, if that makes sense, right? You're not going to see logarithmic corrections to the equations of motion.
But you said unless you drive it, or you were not.
We haven't checked it. Yeah. I don't. They may show up on driving. They may not. It's something we hope to do.
Okay.
So this is a related question. So this is, does this really then apply to this turbulent state? I mean, this is more like a gas.
Remember, the small parameter is basically c squared over r star squared. So if r star is like 5c, in the simulations I showed, that was certainly true for most pairs of vortices. And yet you saw sort of highly chaotic behavior that at least, that's what's called superfluid turbulence. You could take issue with that by saying this is not the same as classical turbulence, which is correct. But that's what's called superfluid turbulence. So. We're not at finite temperature yet, but okay.
The statistics of the vortices is probably not known in the superfluid state, in the turbulent state.
What do you mean by this? You mean in the experiments with the what this?
Just what type of statistics?
Okay, the procedure we're doing is self-consistent. We take an action, we have an onset for a solution which is at leading order correct, and this is what you find. Whether or not this corresponds to the experiment, we have to wait and see. Okay, now the main point I want to make is that vortex-anti-vortex pairs are not unstable. Now, I use that term because I always forget. You know, basically, what you do, or what you find, at least with our preliminary results, is that if you kick a vortex-anti-vortex pair, it basically just harmonic oscillates around its background solution. So there's no instability towards vortex annihilation, and therefore this is, essentially would describe an inverse cascade. If you put n of these vortices together, they'll necessarily form large-scale structures. And there's some very famous simulations by Sigia and RF, I believe, from the 80s. And there's another recent paper which emphasized the role of this negative temperature Ansager state, which is basically the statement that the end goal, or the end result of the inverse cascade, in principle, should be a state where you have two essentially vortex lattices, one of all plus vortices, one of all minus vortices, and they just circulate around each other quickly. And there's a couple of subtleties with losing enough energy, or actually dumping enough energy into the system to reach that state, but you can read that paper if you want. Okay, so that's all I want to say about zero temperature. What we're really interested in is finite temperature physics. At finite temperature, the normal fluid, or whatever is there, I mean, we're going to be very vague for the purposes of this talk about what's actually there, dumps, you can essentially transfer momentum and energy from superfluid vortices into this normal fluid through interactions at the vortex core. And just by symmetries, the leading order corrections to the equations of motion necessarily have to take this form. So whatever the loss of momentum is from the superfluid, due to vortex n, it has to be proportional at leading order. So if we, you know, if all the velocities are small, we can Taylor expand. And at linear order, there's two types of terms you could get. So one is this eta term, which basically is just a classic drag force. That, you know, you drive a vortex through, there's a force that points behind the velocity. And this one's a transverse force. Pn, no. Pn is not conjugate to xn. Actually, like, y is conjugate to x, because these are first order equations. P is literally the momentum. This is literally the rate at which the system loses momentum. So this... Okay, that's on the next slide. But I just want to point out quickly that these eta and eta prime really depend on interactions at the vortex core. And you really need a microscopic calculation to obtain these. And this is beyond hydrodynamics or the effective field theory that we're going to be doing.
They have done fibers, right?
Yes, I mean, so actually, you know, the finite temperature HVI equations have terms that look like this in them. But these are not really novel equations. I mean, there's not, so as you can see, there aren't very many terms, so it's not hard to find both of them. But what I would just point out is that, again, this procedure was not done consistently, and in particular, some higher order terms were included, but not others. So all we're pointing out is don't include spurious higher order terms. This is the equation of motion at leading order. Okay, let me quickly sort of go through what this dp dt is, because it's actually quite simple. So if I consider a vortex at rest, it has, and I consider it in a background superfluid velocity, capital V, which is sort of very small. So at leading order, So the velocities are given by this. So that I just superimpose the background field on top of my vortex. And you can use Landau's two-fluid theory of superfluids to compute the momentum flux around a disk at infinity. In the vortex rest frame, the superfluid momentum flux tensor takes a form very similar to what it is for a classical fluid, except that mu is basically playing the analog of the superfluid pressure. And if this is a static solution, you can essentially the Euler equation implies that equation for mu, and you can do the calculation in a couple of lines, and you find what essentially is the Magnus force. And the Magnus force exists for classical vortices. It exists for these superfluid vortices as well. And it's basically a transverse force that's proportional to the difference of x dot and v. Okay, so now let me clean up a couple things. So as I pointed out, the whole sort of song and dance about zero temperature taught us that we can ignore all of the sound-induced corrections in the superfluid itself. So as far as the superfluid is concerned, the only velocities that matter are the long-range velocities due to other vortices themselves. You can show more carefully that the corrections to the equations of motion are suppressed by 1 over r star squared. And remember, c over r star was our small parameter. You can do a similar exercise for the normal fluid by considering how much momentum and energy is injected at these vortex cores. So this induces basically traveling sound waves with the vortices, kind of like a cloud of sound, if you like. But by the time you get close to another vortex, the magnitude of this cloud is also 1 over r star squared suppressed. And it's consistent, therefore, at leading order to treat the normal fluid as static. So this is a justification, if you like, for why it was OK in the holographic simulations to assume that this plasma background had no velocity. Okay, this is just a statement that we're working in a dilute gas of vortices. OK, so our final equation of motion, we just put this all together, setting u equals to 0, and we get these equations, which are a simpler version of arguably the classical, the HVI equations from 50 years ago. But we don't have to include every term. It's just these. OK, now let's simulate these equations. So this is a simulation with 500 vortices. And we put eta in the appropriate dimensionless units to be about 1/10. And in particular, you see that you start with a fairly ordered state, and immediately things become disordered. And this is very much like these holographic simulations that showed a very strong direct cascade. We put them in by hand at time t equals 0, but we move them according to the equation of motion on the previous line. If they get too close together, this is a finite time singularity. But we know physically this means the vortices annihilate. So we just remove them by hand. OK, and it's getting very slow. So let me just emphasize the beginning one more time before moving on. Oh, sorry. OK. So we start with an ordered state of 16 clumps of, I think, like 20 vortices each. What? Well, the point is that, you know, there's a very clear structure on a length scale that's the box size. Yes, each cluster is random. Those are essentially, you know, you have to be careful because there are going to be pathological lattice solutions to these equations of motion that are unstable. So we're just, you know, making sure that we start in an unstable solution that leads to turbulence. So you evolve the system forward in time. You see that the original order is rapidly destroyed, and there's a very rapid rate of vortices annihilating each other. I'll show you a movie of more or less that later. But you get inverse cascades, basically. This is a direct cascade. We can't formally announce that yet because there's still some tests to do. But I mean, this looks and quacks like a direct cascade to me. Right? You can clearly see many annihilation events, and this suggests energy is dumping into the UV. We can also check for Kolmogorov scaling, and we get results that, you know, this simulation is from last night. We get results that are comparable to the quality of the science results. Maybe not quite as good, but you see about an order of magnitude of 5/3. One nice thing I will point out, though, is that, you know, the simulations to obtain this run in maybe 15, 20 minutes. So in a couple of weeks, you know, we're planning on ramping these up by an order of magnitude in terms of the size of the simulation. So hopefully this plot will be very much improved. But I would say, you know, this is a hint that we're really seeing this Kolmogorov scaling just in these simple equations. Now let me finally explain why vortices annihilate. And this is a very simple calculation. So consider a vortex-antivortex pair, just two of them for now, okay? And they're separated by initial distance r star. If you don't have any vortex drag, it's pretty simple to show that the solution to the point vortex equations is that this pair just travels together in a straight line for all time. And they move at velocity 1 over m times r star. If eta is much smaller than 1, though, you can show that there's essentially a very small component of the velocity that pulls these vortices in together. And you can exactly calculate the annihilation time and up to some coefficients of pi's and whatnot. It turns out to be this guy. So it's the superfluid density over vortex drag times r star squared. Okay. And at vortex density n, the rate of annihilation is proportional to n. And thus, the time derivative of the density should be roughly proportional to eta times n squared. Let me point out that, as far as I can tell, this is an accident that this happens to look like the answer you would have guessed if you just went based on kinetic theory, right? So, you know, or if you're just doing chemical kinetics, you might say, okay, well, for an annihilation event, you know, two vortices have to come together. The probability this happens is proportional to density times density. I get density squared. But these annihilation events are not random, okay? It's a deterministic process once two vortices get close together. The reason it takes a long time is because these vortices are moving slowly. Okay. So I would argue that this proportionality with n, you should not think of this as a chemical kinetic result. This has to do with the 1 over r velocities. Just something I think is important conceptually. You can solve this equation, and you get this very simple answer. Okay. The number of vortices, you know, at late time should be falling off as 1 over t. And the time scale in the problem is related, basically, again, to this ratio of eta over rho s. So in the movies that we showed, we can count the number of vortices. That's a very simple thing to do. And this is, you know, one run of the simulation with all the noise, you know, included. But you can see that this is essentially, I would say, a pretty good theory. This is a decent fit. And by the way, you know, the proportionality coefficient is about 10, but that's not so bad when you consider that we've dropped some pi's and 4's and along the way. Okay, let me now return back to the experiment. So the experiment made a very big deal about this equation and their observation of it in this Bose-Einstein condensate. So there were two ways that vortices could go away. One is that they just leave the imaging region, as I mentioned. And the second was that they actually do annihilate. And the reason I made a big deal about this n squared annihilation rate is because this paper essentially made it sound, at least to me, as though the reason for this n squared was just chemistry, or kinetic theory, if you like. But this, okay, well, I would argue this is not true, right? Okay. Okay, in any case, misconception, but they do get the right answer, and they're able to. Okay, there's some plot. I find it very confusing because they tried to fit it in 4 pages, but okay, you can see that there's experimental results. They do see that this equation is obeyed, and in particular, they're able to measure gamma 2 for a variety of initial conditions. And they say that gamma 2 is proportional to t squared over mu, and then times this sort of trivial volume factor. It may be possible that this is really the first experimental determination through superfluid turbulence of this microscopic vortex drag coefficient in their experimental BEC.
So what was mu again?
Mu is chemical potential.
So this eta not be confused with some, is it related to some of the coefficients in the equation of superfluid hydrodynamics, which have various viscosities? There's about 5 different viscosities there.
No, we just picked the letter eta, but we can talk afterwards. I mean, they may formally be related. I would say, though, that I really think, partly guided by the Hall graphic simulation, that these etas are microscopic calculations, right? So it's you're saying that there's also phenomenological coefficients in hydro that, you know, these are maybe proportional to. Oh,
in fact, Paul sent me an email about just this question last night, so now I know what he was asking.
Okay. There's probably a way to map it, but, you know, we're sort of stupid high energy physicists, and we didn't know the conventions. So these are just R variables, but yeah, okay. But we can talk afterwards. Okay, so now when we come back to Subir's point, if eta is very small, it doesn't even have to be 0. You see very different physics. And in particular, you can't really identify a lot of annihilation events here. And instead, you see that there's very large structures starting to form. So if I can do this in real time, there's basically a giant red cluster here, a blue cluster here. And you can see that essentially, here it looks like energy is really going to flow to large length scales. Formally, this cannot persist for all time. And the reason for that is because when eta is positive, energy is dissipated. This is very simple to see. And therefore, because essentially clumping positive vortices together takes a lot of energy, this positive cluster has to sort of spread apart at infinite times. But for very long time scales, we're seeing essentially the hallmarks of what appear to be an inverse cascade. And there's a very simple scaling argument which suggests that perhaps the inverse cascade will stop at a length scale of R star divided by eta in the appropriate dimensionless units. I think there should be a rho S R star over eta, I believe. Ideally, that's what we would like, but we're not there yet. I mean, this is very much a preliminary thought. But I do. But what I really want to just stress is that this is a model that, by tuning this eta, we can really go from something that's a manifest direct cascade to something that smells like an inverse cascade. And from the point of view of the turbulent literature, we haven't seen something like this before, where just this you start with this very simple model and essentially. So here we used eta of about 0.002, I believe. The first simulation had eta of 0.1. And so, yeah, it would be very interesting if we can understand essentially more precisely this inverse cascade versus direct cascade. But yeah.
Sorry, in this movie, I was noticing that you are not allowing for annihilation.
No. Formally, you could, but they just don't happen very often.
Basically, this drag is not strong enough to do
close. They come close.
Yeah. So why are you not removing this?
Yeah, they just move close enough. Each other. And
what?
You're not removing the vortices that are really close. Why is that?
Well, so we put in by hand just a microscopic scale at which vortices annihilate. This would be sort of in our simulation, the analog of the core size. Okay. And in this simulation, we haven't removed it, but what happens is that the drag force is basically not strong enough to bring vortices that close together. If you have a pair that
they look close,
but remember, we have lots and lots of vortices here. So even if there was an inverse cascade, some of them aren't going to look close.
The annihilation condition is the same in both
simulations. Yeah. We haven't played any funny business there. The annihilation condition is identical. It's just in this simulation, when two vortices start to get close, another vortex passes by and just perturbs that simple calculation I showed you so much that the annihilation event doesn't happen. That's the way you should think about it.
So, is there a tuning eta in your holographic theory?
Not that we know of. One of the goals is to actually compute eta holographically, because that's for us, that's sort of the easiest way to do it. I think the problem is the traditional methods in the CMT literature are somewhat controversial. That's why people can't agree on these results.
Coefficients.
Yeah.
The analog of the Bardeen-Stephen coefficients for single vortices, I think there's been work on them. I have to look up, but I think
what I would say is people have certainly tried to get these coefficients, but it's not universally agreed what they are. For example, it's kind of like with the mass, some people said the mass was zero, some people said it was divergent. There's similar issue here. So, anyway, we can talk more later.
There's a lot of garbage on the mass issue, but I think.
Okay, we can talk more later, but I would say, from what we read, it doesn't seem like there's a clear consensus on what the answer is.
Proportionality.
This coefficient is T-squared, which
always goes as T-squared, right?
We don't know. That would be great if it does, because then we would be able to explain much of the experiment. But we don't know if that's true. In fact, I believe the Thompson paper said this would be T to the fourth, if I recall. Yeah. It seems to me, at least, that the temperature scaling would be somewhat sensitive to essentially the quasi-particles in the normal fluid, what their low energy dispersion spectrum looks like, for example. So it's not clear to me that this should always be T squared. But if there is a very simple argument for that, we would love to hear it. Okay, and one more thing I want to point out here is there's really no, there's no 5/3. And, you know, I realize that I think the reason why is because this is very small eta, yeah. But the Kolmogorov argument, if you reverse the direction of energy flow, formally it would also apply to 2D inverse cascade turbulence. You imagine that you drive the system at a UV scale, energy flux goes, you know, mode to mode to the box scale, and by dimensional analysis you get the same answer. I would argue that the reason we can't see it here is because this is not a driven system. The reason you can see it for the direct cascade is because there secretly is a driving mechanism, which is basically vortex annihilation. So you can dump energy out by essentially annihilating two vortices. And that is, it seems to me at least, that's why you can observe this direct cascade, or this Kolmogorov spectrum in direct cascade superfluid turbulence, but not in inverse cascade.
You could use the same argument in regular hydro. And there you do see it minus, you do see the minus 5/3 after you're cascading inversely. So why would it work?
Well, but okay, formally, right, the argument requires driving.
It just requires that you're in the inertial regime where energy is going from one scale
okay,
to another.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't require driving at all.
Okay, well, the inertial regime would sort of shrink as a function of time then. Okay, yes. Yeah, okay, so maybe we don't have a big enough system size then. But I guess the point is perhaps it's more robust for the direct cascade because it is being secretly driven. Whereas this one, you would just have to have a huge system so that you get a robust inertial range. But we don't, you know, these aren't final answers. I mean, this is very much a work in progress. So I'm happy to hear other thoughts. Okay, so I guess let me just conclude quickly. So we've showed that there's a chaotic regime of superfluid vortex dynamics governed by a simple effective field theory of first order dynamics. I also want to emphasize that, you know, these HVI equations need to be revisited systematically. You can't just add a mass and call it a day. It's more complicated than that. And especially for zero temperature dynamics, I mean, this is arguably something that needs to be done. I also hope I've convinced you that a very reasonable mechanism for a direct cascade and driven by vortex annihilation is simply vortex drag. And, you know, although these equations were written down for quite some time, we don't believe this has really been an appreciated fact. We also, if we can show that eta is t squared, we would have results directly consistent with the recent experimental results. And finally, I just want another thing to stress. This EFT is really simple on a computer. And there's no reason, if this is correct at least, there's no reason to solve these fluid PDEs. You don't need to solve the Gross-Potiyevsky equation or, you know, holography. To look at large-scale turbulence, you can just look at this simple effective theory, and that should. Yeah. I mean, but.
At least for normal fluid, there's been a lot of work like that. There was Weichmann and Cross, and there were also similar equations.
For normal fluid turbulence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this paper by Sigia I cited a while back, that basically argued that they could study the inverse cascade with pure point vortex dynamics. I think conceptually, though, that's a little bit problematic, because if you look at simulations of inverse cascade, you know, normal fluid turbulence, you don't see well-defined vortex objects persisting for large times. I mean, they really are shearing and merging, and you're just not going to capture that with point vortex dynamics. With a superfluid, what? Yeah, exactly. That's why this is really, really a good approach, because essentially it's a topological condition. These vortices cannot spread out. So we really think this is a much better approach for superfluids.
And of course, that last statement depends on what question you're after, right?
Right, okay. If you're interested in the microscopics of how vortices annihilate, the sort of quantification of these crescent waves, obviously the effective theory won't give you that. We're talking here, though, about understanding, you know, there's, okay, so let me now go to the next slide. One of the things that we still don't know is how similar are classical and superfluid turbulence. I mean, I just argued that, you know, classical turbulence, these vortices can shear, they can deform. And in superfluid turbulence, they can't. To what extent is that shearing of vortices sort of responsible for much of the physics of a classical turbulent fluid? Or is it not so responsible? And we don't know the answer to these. You know, if it turns out that that's not so important, then perhaps these effective theories of superfluid turbulence can actually teach us something about normal fluid turbulence. That's a very optimistic point of view, but you know, there's more in common between these two phenomena than you might have expected. A priori, why should a collection of superfluid vortices have anything that looks like turbulence? But yet they seem to at least have, you know, hints of Kolmogorov scaling. Another thought is that particle vortex duality may provide a simpler route to the effective theory at zero temperature. This is something I'm certainly not an expert in, but maybe someone here would have some interesting thoughts about that. Another thought is, again, to the extent to which these microscopic coefficients, their scaling with things like temperature is universal. And I don't see any reason why they have to be, but maybe they are. But we just don't know. And the last point I would like to make is that we hope that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of previous simulations on superfluid turbulence were in stark disagreement over very basic questions, like do large-scale structures form? Do you have a direct or inverse cascade? This theory, we've shown that, you know, if you only have 100 vortices, you can have a very long-lived simulation where by tuning a single parameter, you can go between these regimes quite starkly. So perhaps we can actually help to shed some light on why these simulations, if they're all studying superfluid turbulence at finite temperature, can give such different answers. And in particular, can we identify sort of transitions on between inverse and direct cascades on different length and time scales in this model, and perhaps shed some light on turbulence that way? So, okay, that's all I have to say. Thanks for your attention.
So any further questions? You can bombard it with them. Yeah, one. The context of turbulence in superfluid helium-4 in three dimension. Mm-hmm. People have done lots of experiments.
Right.
And looked at the vertex tangles and various phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to make some connection to classical turbulence, but I don't know the.
There's a similar statement you could make, right, which is that. These vortex lines now still are quantized, so that's still somewhat different. I don't know to what extent, you know, I think the two-dimensional phenomena is quite different just because you don't have this shearing of line vortices. But yeah, there's certainly been a lot of work on that that you probably know more about than I do. So.
Can you add corrections to your equations to go beyond the dilute regime and simulate those, or the equations just become?
That was part of what I was trying to point out. At zero temperature, at least, you know, there are very systematic procedures for doing this, basically analogous to in quantum field theory, just integrating out fluctuations and finding an effective action. Since we don't really know how to do for any field theory, well-behaved action approaches at finite temperature, I don't know of. I think you just have to do it order by order in the equations of motion. But in principle, yes, you could do this. You could find corrections. We've argued that these corrections are all subleading in our limit. But yes, as the density of vortices approaches, right. So that they're kind of almost like, you know, sphere packed together. Yeah, I mean this is going to break down. One note, though, in that limit is you may not have well-defined vortices to begin with. So this whole approach might just not make sense. Right? For this approach to be reasonable, you have to have a well-defined vortex. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to talk about their positions.
Okay, just a reminder, so Anne is here till Friday next week or so.
Yeah.
Given that you said that your code takes 15 minutes, you can be given lots of homework. So, we have some more questions. So, where you get those really cool T-shirts? It's in the second floor of this building.
Thanks.